For the last 2 weeks, since he erroneously claimed victory on election night, President Donald Trump has been spewing baseless claims about Joe Biden's presidential win, which he alleges is based on voter fraud. These allegations from the president have ignited numerous conspiracy theories and a general mood of distrust for the election results among many of his supporters. For more on the types of false narratives taking grip on social media, what this could mean for the further erosion of our faith in government institutions, and much more, we spoke Wednesday afternoon to David Klepper, a former Capitol reporter in Albany for the Associated Press, who is now reporting on misinformation relating to the elections and COVID-19. So since Election Day, what are some of the conspiracy theories about voter fraud that have emerged, whether from the president or his allies, which you and your colleagues at the AP have had to investigate and, most cases, subsequently refute?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about what we've been seeing is how it actually started long before Election Day, with the president and some of his supporters sowing seeds of doubt about, in particular, voting by mail in the months really leading up to the election. And this, of course, is capitalizing on longstanding distrust amongst that some Americans have about the integrity of our elections. But Donald Trump certainly exploited that in the weeks and months leading up to the election, and really set the stage for what we've seen, which is an explosion in exaggerated claims that are just made up whole cloth, and I think really a poor understanding of things that happen every election that now are being sort of blown way out of proportion.
And what are some of those things that are being either blown out of proportion or just fabricated?
They fall into a couple of general buckets. There's the found ballot narrative, and we've seen this all over the country, in particular in swing states or states where the voting continued after Election Day. This really, I think one of the first ones we saw this year was one supposedly in Pennsylvania where some ballots were found that were, I'm sorry, not supposedly, it was in Pennsylvania. Some discarded ballots were found. It was just a small handful of ballots, but Trump tweeted about this, talked about this, and said it was probably indicative of a much larger problem. However, and this is very typical, when we went and actually looked at the facts and talked to the people who did the investigation, we're talking about 9 ballots that were found that were then added to the vote count. And interestingly, all the details that Trump offered weren't quite correct. He had said that all the ballots were marked for him, but in fact, that's kind of impossible to know because these ballots were sealed. So I think that's a good example of the kind of claim we saw. This really happened. 9 ballots were found. They were discarded. They were found. The system worked. But for people who are skeptical of the system, this was a sign that things were not right. And we have seen similar sort of related claims all around the country. There was a claim made by a postal worker in Pennsylvania that he had been ordered to tamper with ballots. Obviously, investigators looked into this. He recanted. He made the whole story up. He then said he recanted his recantation and said that he had been forced to recant. But then we found audio of him actually saying, yeah, I made this whole thing up. So that's another example of how little misunderstandings or lies can get blown way out of proportion. And the problem is not necessarily what the people in Erie, Pennsylvania think about this, because they have officials who are investigating and can determine the truth. The problem is what people in California or Florida or Ohio or New York think, because they don't know the facts. They just see a claim on Twitter or Facebook without any of the facts and context. And I think it's very easy to understand why people would jump to conclusions because they don't have all the facts. And those conclusions can be very scary. And I think the implications of millions of Americans no longer having trust in our elections, our election officials, our media, is a very scary problem that we're going to be dealing with for many years. So these claims may be small, they may be exaggerated, but the impact they can have, I think, is going to be great.
Do journalists have an obligation to track down every claim from the president and his allies, or is it a mistake to spend limited energy and personnel pursuing every thread that comes out of this narrative?
It's sort of, you know, by flooding the zone to some degree, they're taking up the energy of election officials, journalists who could be doing other work. There's also the danger of amplification, and this is something we wrestle with at the AP every day, that a claim will surface that is wild and potentially dangerous. We know, because we track these things down, that there may be no truth to it, But even just in debunking the claim and writing a story about a claim or a misinformation network or something like that, you can inadvertently amplify the claim. And people who never wondered, gee, is a CIA supercomputer changing votes, might start to wonder that. And so there's a danger. This stuff is dangerous, and you have to be very careful how you talk about it, how you report on it, and how you debunk it.
Aside from the claims tweeted out by the president, how do you and your colleagues go about finding different election fraud theories? Do you have to just sort of go through corners of the internet that the, you know, I guess far right like to frequent, or are there other ways to determine what is the popular narrative among sort of the Trump supporters?
And that's a perfect follow-up to your last question, because with so many different claims out there, with so much misinformation, with millions of claims circulating at any time, you have to make decisions on what you focus on. So at the AP, what we try and do is find claims that are having an impact, you know, that are getting out there and being talked about. And because we think that's our duty to the public, to if they're seeing a claim from their uncle on Facebook and that's being repeated 10 million times across the country, we feel we have an obligation to track that one down. Obviously, we see claims all the time that don't seem to get viral. And those, you know, those are easier to ignore because, I mean, to some degree, this is human nature. Humans like to exaggerate. They like to talk. They like to gossip. So we're not interested in that. We're interested in tracking down the veracity of claims that are really being a focus of the public conversation or that could really change the whole story. I'll give you a for instance. We have been looking at claims that dead voters voted in the election. And this is a claim that's popped up in some of the legal challenges. There was another one about actually the postal worker that I mentioned earlier, Lindsey Graham, mentioned that case in a letter asking for an investigation. Of course, an investigation had already determined that the postal worker was lying. But these claims can really take on a life of their own outside of social media. And that's where we try and focus, the ones that look like they could resonate outside of the echo chamber of Twitter and have a real-world effect.
We're talking about the dissemination of election misinformation being spread by the president and many of his supporters, largely through social media. And our guest is David Klepper, a reporter with the Associated Press on the misinformation beat. Do you ever worry, though, that we as reporters are, you know, too trusting in terms of the institutions that we turn to for answers? You know, when you talk about that case of the Pennsylvania postal worker, there was an investigation by, you know, government institutions. They come out and say one thing, and
right,
we take them at face value to a certain degree, whereas people who are more skeptical of the election results argue that, you know, you can't trust just some report that some bureaucrat has produced. How do we need to manage that, and do we need to be more skeptical, or do we have to take certain things on faith?
I mean, I think we have to be transparent, and we have to be consistent, and we have to be fair. It is sort of a tension because you and I know, having both worked in Albany, we would cover institutions with a great deal of skepticism. You know, this program has created X amount of jobs and pumped this much money into the
right
local economy. Prove it. Where are your facts? You can't back that up. You know, we've all done that. And yet, we have to bring that same level of skepticism and independence, I think, to these stories, and that can be tough when there's stuff out there that you can't quite verify, when there's very scary rumors circulating, and you have an election official, you know, giving you one answer, do you trust him or not? And I think it checks and balances. You know, I think it's just good journalism. You look at the facts, you look at the data, you interview more people. If you're not sure if that election official should be trusted, keep reporting. I think that's the answer. I don't think we really blindly take the word of just about anybody. But there is your question, I think, gets at an important issue in this whole conversation, which is about like kind of trusting in our institutions and in the idea of American democracy. And some of the folks who have spread these claims that the election is rigged would have you believe that potentially thousands, tens of thousands of officials, many of them local people, you know, who serve on an election board, thousands of journalists, thousands of lawyers, thousands of poll workers, thousands of candidates, thousands of volunteers are all conspiring together to do something that's never been done before. it starts to become a little bit difficult to accept that all these things could be going on and yet there's no proof. So I think when you make these outrageous claims that election officials in dozens of counties are rigging an election, you have to have evidence. You have to have more than what we've seen, which are, for instance, one video that went viral was a woman in Michigan who was concerned about vote tabulation. So she went to the election office. She said she saw a car, a Ferrari, with out-of-state plates drive by, and she was convinced that this must have something to do with ballot dumping. Maybe, unlikely, but maybe. But we need more than that. And I think there has been some people who are a little too quick to spread allegations for which there is not evidence.
For baseless or already refuted claims posted on Twitter and Facebook, the social media giants have begun sharing accompanying warnings that the messages or videos are essentially fake news or at the very least disputed. Is there any indication that this is slowing the spread of misinformation, or does it play into a narrative that they're trying to squash the truth from getting out there?
The latter. Absolutely. It is something that we deal with a lot, which if you tell people, hey, listen, that tweet you put out is not quite right. Here's the facts. They tend to become entrenched. And from a psychological standpoint, it's understandable. Nobody likes being told that they're wrong. And so these labels have really only fed into these concerns that many conservatives have that social media is somehow censoring them or is biased in favor of the left. And the same could be true with media fact checks. We get a lot of pushback when we will fact check people. It's almost as if they are more convinced that they're right after being given the facts showing that they're wrong. And that's a tough problem to solve. I think, frankly, a lot of this goes back to media literacy and critical thinking and things that we need to probably stress in school more than we do. Social media is difficult. It's difficult to use. It looks easy, but the implications are complicated and potentially destructive. So I think we probably need to get a little better at teaching people how to use these tools that make life so much better in many ways, but also open up all these new challenges that our democracy is going to have to really come to grips with.
I agree with you, but how do you start that conversation without sounding like an elitist snob who's trying to talk down to people? Because as you say that, I can imagine the people pushing back and say, well, who's going to teach that media literacy class?
Right.
You know, my teachers are advancing a liberal agenda or something else. I just don't understand how you could even accomplish this.
It's such a tough challenge. In the short term, like in a story, we often use what is called a truth sandwich. And forgive me, I can't remember the very smart researcher who came up with the term.
Sounds
but if
delicious.
You remind people of something, of a truth that they already know, for instance, if you remind them, elections often aren't called on election night. Elections often spill into the next few days and weeks. That is not new. Therefore, President Trump is incorrect when he says that these are illegal ballots. If you remind people of the truth first and then show them where the falsehood is, the studies show that's more effective in getting people to reexamine their views. You obviously can't do that all the time. You can't do that at Thanksgiving dinner all the time with every uncle that spouts a conspiracy theory. I think a large part of this problem is going to have to be dealt with over the next years. I mean, this is a years and decades long challenge. I think this is going to be a challenge for the Biden administration to show whether they are really going to try and govern from the middle. I think this is a media problem. We have to be more transparent about how we operate, what we do. The AP really tried to be very transparent this year in how we call races, how we fact check, things like that. We've been trying to be more upfront and say, this is what we do. This is how we do it. And so, you know, you can decide for yourself. To a large degree, this comes down to trust. And I think many Americans had more trust in these institutions in generations past than they do now. And we have to rebuild that. And, you know, there is no easy answer, unfortunately.
I think the AP is spinning its wheels by spending that extra time, because the people who are reading the AP are reading the AP because they already have faith in your type of journalism that you get from
right
there. And the people who don't have, you know, trust the AP.
Aren't going to be convinced.
And they're getting their journal, their quote-unquote journalism elsewhere. They're getting it from a random video of a woman, you know, talking about a Ferrari that she saw outside of the Board of Elections. So it just...
Well, my hope is that if, and I've gotten these emails and DMs on Twitter from people, you know, who do you think you are at the AP to do this, to call this race, et cetera. And I think explaining what we do is helpful. And I do suspect that there are people that went online and Googled, you know, who is the AP on election night or the days after. And hopefully they found those stories and they might have answered some questions for them. We cannot control the conclusions people draw, but we can give them access to information, and hopefully you know, that will be helpful to them. I think you're right, there are people that are just dead set in their views, and there are also people for whom that is not necessary, that kind of explanation. But I still believe there are probably people in the middle who are not firmly entrenched in one camp or the other, who have questions, and you know, hopefully we can help answer them.
The increased use of these fact checks by social media companies during the pandemic and now the elections has prompted a transition away from some of these sites to a new social media site. One of them is Parler, which has been really growing in popularity among conservatives as a site where anything goes. What do you know about Parler in terms of who it's been attracting and what is getting posted there?
I am on Parler. I've been on Parler for several months because this migration has been going on for a while. As conservatives who are concerned about the increased use of these fact checks look for somewhere else to go. Parler is an interesting place. It in some ways is more like Reddit used to be when they would talk about Trump. Reddit has also cracked down on much of the Trump content on its site, the Trump misinformation anyway. The Parler has much less moderation, basically no moderation, so it's a little bit more freewheeling than what you see on Facebook. I would say, however, and I mean no disrespect to its developers, I think one look at Parler shows you just what kind of a challenge these people are up against. You go to Facebook, you see recipes, you see pictures of dogs and grandkids, and grandparents, travel, and politics and misinformation thrown in. Parler is just politics and misinformation. It is a much less joyful experience, if one can ever use the term joyful to describe social media. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if it works, if it expands, if it becomes more of a place of different things besides politics. We have seen a number of prominent conservatives publicly declare that they're moving to Parler. I have noted, however, very few that have given up Facebook or Twitter. It appears to be mostly they're adding it on in addition as a way to speak to their more conservative supporters. I have seen a number of just rank and file American conservatives say they're giving up Facebook and moving entirely to Parler. And I've seen one or two complain that they don't like the site. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. We've seen this happen or attempted before. This time seems a little different. You know, it, certainly the response from the social media platforms to this election was different. And I suspect some of the anger that conservatives are feeling might last a little bit longer this time. So we'll see. I'm on Parler for the long term. I encourage people out there to join and friend me if you are.
Yeah, Mike.
We can figure out how to use it together.
Well, that's the issue I've had so far with the site, and I joined it, and I don't find it very user-friendly. You know, while you were talking, I tried to find the David Klepper account, and I can't find it. I don't, the search functions aren't good. I've had it crash on me.
You can't do nearly the things you can do that you can do on Facebook. It's very difficult to upload video. It's very difficult, as you say, to search. So, you know, it shows the conservatives may be unhappy with how they believe they're treated on Facebook, but I can't see anything else replicating that environment anytime soon.
You made the comparison for Parler to Reddit, and if I remember correctly, Reddit was where the QAnon conspiracy was born. Mm-hmm. And this is, for listeners, a conspiracy that included the idea that Hillary Clinton and her allies were involved in a child sex trafficking ring out of a Washington, D.C. pizza parlor. Are we going to get that from Parler now? I mean, is that the type of dialogue and, critical thinking that's going to happen on Parler?
There's a lot of that on there. There's a lot of that still on Facebook, too, and Twitter. I think that the issue with Parler is if you totally silo these kinds of conversations off and you don't have pictures of grandkids or recipes, et cetera, you're not going to draw in an eclectic group. So it's going to be kind of a radicalizing community. You know, it's going to be an echo chamber where the same conspiracy theories are passed around, and you're not going to have a whole lot of one people with fresh eyes saying, wait a minute, you believe what? And two, you're also not going to have fresh eyes exposed to this. So it's going to be a more of a self-selective group. It's going to be interesting to see how Parler manages this, because they're proudly less into moderation, of course, than Twitter or Facebook. But if some of the content starts to get a little potentially dangerous with threats of violence or something like that, we will see calls, I'm sure, to crack down.
When it comes to a COVID-19 vaccine, are you expecting there to be a almost shift in how it's perceived after January 20th when Joe Biden takes office? I mean, right now you've got in New York, let's say, Governor Andrew Cuomo, who expresses a lot of skepticism about the virus, the vaccine approval process, and is espousing a lot of critiques about the planned distribution. And I wonder whether, you know, when 2021 comes around and the Biden administration is responsible for distribution, do you think you'll see among people on the right a newfound skepticism about the federal government taking something like this on that might not have been present if President Trump was in charge of distributing the vaccine, and the vice versa,
I think, right,
with Cuomo?
I think you will see a shift in who is making what claim. We've already seen claims that the good news about the vaccines was purposefully withheld until the election was called so as not to help Trump. So I'm sure we're going to see that kind of thing. Interestingly, the vaccine issue is one that skews both to the left and the right, because there are plenty of people on the left who were concerned about what they were calling a Trump vaccine, who may still very well be concerned about, quote-unquote, big pharma, as well as the growing number of people that are concerned about vaccines in general. We've been tracking pretty carefully the vaccine hesitancy rate. It seems to be reducing slightly now that we have this promising news about these two vaccines, but I know that's going to be a real issue. And again, that's why misinformation is so important. We're not just talking about uncles on social media talking about tinfoil hats. This could change the rate at which Americans take this vaccine. So that has real implications, and I think it's a great example of why misinformation is just such a growing force and factor in world events.
Well, we've been speaking with David Klepper. He is a reporter with the Associated Press, and he is on the misinformation beat. David, it was a real pleasure to spend time with you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Oh, David, it's always a pleasure. Hope Albany is treating you well.
You've been listening to the Capitol Press Room, which you can take with you on the go wherever you download podcasts. Our engineer in Syracuse is Dave White. My producer in Albany is Tim Williams. I'm David Lombardo. Thanks for listening.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.